This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July 11th, 2016. I'm Ed Zollers. We're going to be talking this week about what's going on here in the area of federal taxes. This week, it's going to be dealing with data attack as we look at this background. Current Federal Tax Developments, a podcast, as always, is brought to you by your state CPA societies and Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. Now, this week, we're going to have a few stories we're going to talk about here. So what we'll do this week, we're going to talk about an IRS warning preparers to be aware of data loss and the potential for attack on data. We'll talk about that. That was something we discussed last week. The service is going to start doing. Now they've actually done it for the first time. We have proposed regulations on the healthcare credit that provide information on how you design an opt-out program if you want to give employees funds who basically decide they'll opt out of your healthcare coverage, and how to do that in a way that doesn't increase your exposure to the shared responsibility penalty. We also find out in a court case what didn't work in terms of proving equitable ownership for a resident. A court of appeals agrees with the tax court that a working interest owner is subject to self-employment tax as a partner, despite the fact the working interest had an election out of the partnership treatment. And finally, we'll talk about how the IRS explains to the tax court about how it applied a refund before it actually received the return and why that makes sense. Again, as always, this is brought to you by your state societies of CPAs. And as always, I'm going to be coming up and doing some courses around the country. Got some coming up. It'll be in the state of Iowa in September. So I want to bring those up to you if you're in Iowa. I'll be in Iowa City on September 7th and 8th, and I'll be doing fringe benefits on the 7th. And real estate partnerships, getting in, getting out, and getting taxed on the 8th. Then on September the 23rd, I'll be in Sioux City, and I will be dealing with assisting the survivors, the CPA's role in the decedent's estate. That course will talk specifically about the Iowa Principal and Income Act. And then on September 24th, we'll also talk about fringe benefits, again, repeat the fringe benefits courses. So if you're in Iowa and you're going to be around and available there, I'd look forward to seeing you here in September. So if you're thinking about that, looking at booking something either just before or just after the September 15th deadlines, go ahead, take a look there and, find something that may be of your liking in the courses. Also, be sure to check the catalogs for all the state societies. We offer courses all over the country, and other people are offering excellent courses all over the country. So be sure that you take advantage of those offerings from the state society. Well, let's go ahead and move forward now to our first case for the week. And the first thing we're going to talk about this week is going to be that IRS warning to preparers. This case, we have IRS news release, IR 2016-96, and fact sheet 2016-23. And this is where the IRS followed up on something we discussed last week. You may remember that last week we discussed the fact that the IRS was going to be reaching out to preparers as part of the security summit. Well, we ended up with the first step in that this week. This is regarded in these news releases and the fact sheet. Now, the IRS, as we said, outlined steps preparers should take to secure data. And some of those here are pretty straightforward. You'll see them. They're in the fact sheet. I certainly suggest you take a look at that in your practice, because if anything goes wrong, you're going to have a real problem showing, if anything goes wrong in your practice, anything happens, data gets loose, you're going to have real trouble, I think, in terms of liability if it turns out you didn't have at least these things in place, because the argument's going to be you were told by the IRS, and you do tax work, so supposedly you're reading what the IRS sends out, about these are steps that should be taken. If you haven't taken those steps, don't be surprised if plaintiff's counsel argues that, well, had you taken those steps, we wouldn't have had this problem. So some of those they talk about here is they say they want you to assure that taxpayer data, including data left on hardware or media, is never left unsecured. So that'll mean doing things like having passwords on your machines when you walk away from your machines, making sure the password that the screen blanker kicks in and the password, you need a password to get back in. You need strong passwords, numbers, symbols, upper and lowercase on all computers and tax software programs. They suggest requiring password changes every 60 to 90 days. They say you want to store taxpayer data in secure systems and encrypt information when transmitting. You might want to look at what you're doing in terms of encrypting data, both at your servers, data that's on the backups from your servers, and data that is transmitted to your clients. Ensure that email being sent or received that contains taxpayers' data is encrypted and secure. Make sure paper documents, computer disks, flash drives, and other medias like your backup are kept in a secure location and restrict the access to authorized users only. Use caution when allowing or granting remote access to internal networks containing sensitive data. That includes coming to a conclusion about how much access you should grant even your IT people in terms of, or basically you might want to seriously consider, and one thing I think that does make sense, do you really want to leave those access points for your IT people up when your IT people aren't in the system? You know, if your IT guy needs to work on something, maybe we let them in. But when they're not working on it, you know, if you leave it up, I don't care how secured it is, leaving it up leaves an opening to get in the system. So you may seriously want to consider, you know, having controls that you have to approve when anybody from the outside gets in, so you can pay attention to what they're doing. And you can assure that somebody at 2 a.m. from somewhere around the world is not sitting in and, you know, browsing the data on your servers because they found a way in via an opening you left for your IT person to get in. So that's obviously something you should be considering. Terminate access to taxpayer information, anybody who's no longer employed. Revoke passwords, do that sorts of things. Create security requirements for your entire staff regarding computer information systems, proper records, and use of taxpayer data. Question you're going to be asked is, you know, what steps, what do you tell your staff they have to do in terms of securing data? Do you have provisions? And if you do, please, what are they and where are they documented? Key issues you'll have to deal with. You want to create periodic security training to update staff members on any changes and ensure compliance. Protect your facilities from unauthorized access and potential dangers, and create a plan on required steps to notify taxpayers should you become a victim of any breach or theft. And the last one, unfortunately, is brings a piece of reality to the mix. Regardless of what you do, regardless of how many steps you take, regardless of how well you put everything together, people might still get in. We had this last week, a major breach that some of you got an email of. I know Drake sent one out. If you use any of the Symantec security products, desperately important that you update those instantly. Frankly, if you can't update them, disable them, because the hole in those without the update is probably far worse than running without the protection. In essence, they have opened there are a number of well-known holes, if you're running the security protection, that can be taken advantage of simply by sending an email. Doesn't have to be opened by anybody, just sending it, getting into your system. And once in there, they can then leverage that to essentially take over everything else. Again, if you're using any Symantec security product, and that includes anything with the Norton name, that's also where we find Symantec, you want to make very, very, very sure that you have applied updates and that you check to make sure it has been updated within the past week or so. You want to see the security, the software, not just your signatures. That's not your problem. It's the basic underlying software had significant, huge flaws. And so you want to be aware. So the problem is, even if you do things like, as you've been told, do what you've done, have security software in place, may turn out there's still problems that you just can't deal with. Like it or not, we've got to trust a lot of people in our system. We can't have full control over security. You have to trust people like Microsoft, the people doing your firewall systems, all those things. We got to trust they're doing it right, or Symantec in this case. And if they're not, you know, your systems may be compromised and conceivably could be compromised, you know, without you knowing they've been compromised. So again, that's why the IRS suggests, like it or not, you better have a system down as to what you do if you get compromised. Now, the IRS strongly suggests that you read the fact sheet and publication 4557, which is a PDF, 20-some page PDF that's available. The link is in our materials this week to that. You should review that here during the down season, right? We're outside of the tax season. Review that and consider getting these procedures in place before the upcoming tax season. We fully expect that people looking to steal data, you know, as the IRS locks things down, what's going to start happening is we're going to see that even with the IRS lockdowns, we're going to find that people are going to turn, these guys are going to turn to places they think are easier pickings. They already hit the states a couple of years ago because they were easier pickings. Obviously, the next thing to do is to hit preparers, because many of them don't have systems that are up to speed. And, you know, they're going to take advantage of that, like it or not. Not good news, but definitely something you should be aware of and something you need to be taking care of. Next up, we have IRS has issued proposed regulations dealing with the healthcare credit. This is Regulation 10986-15, issued on July the 8th. This particular regulation, by the way, was issued in a form that it can be relied upon by taxpayers, so you can use this. Now, the regulations technically relate to the premium health credit, and obviously you can read that in detail if you're looking at that for applying it to somebody, because it does have some interesting information there. One of the biggest things in this one, though, is a description of how employers can design an opt-out program that won't increase their shared responsibility liability. The issue that we're looking at here was a question of, let's say you have an employee, you pay for your health insurance for all employees. So you pay 100% of the coverage, or you pay whatever percentage there is. But one of your employees is covered under their spouse's plan, and their spouse has a better plan. They prefer that plan, so they don't want to be on your coverage. So can you design a program where they are paid, you know, where they basically get paid for that? And we won't talk about the tax aspects of it. Otherwise, we're going to talk about the shared responsibility aspects of this. And the issue in that case becomes, the answer becomes effectively, that the IRS says there is a way to do it, but you got to be careful. You have to limit your opt-out, you know, basically people who get opt-out payments has to be specifically limited to people who have other qualifying coverage in a group plan. It cannot be coverage obtained on the individual market, whether or not obtained on the exchange. So you have to limit it to somebody who is covered under a group plan. If you don't do that, then the problem we get in this case is, if you don't do that, since you offered opt-out and you didn't limit it to people who are covered by a group plan, you have to add the amount any employee could get to their wages in computing how much, you know, basically is the required contribution, because it's assumed you're not really paying for it, because if the employee who doesn't take the coverage gets cash and they can just not take the coverage by going somewhere else, or, you know, by going to the open market, that's considered to be a major problem. And the IRS is going to say, well, then that's really part of the cost of coverage. And conceivably, then you could get stuck with additional penalties because you're going to have an unaffordable coverage. And if that person goes to the exchange, they may be able to get a credit. And depending upon whether you offer coverage to the proper percentage, that could trigger a penalty just based on that person who got coverage, or those persons that do. Or it could even expand up to cause you to be paying it on virtually all employees except for that subtraction if you don't offer to all employees. So obviously, this is a key issue. Again, these proposed regs you can rely upon, so therefore, you can do that. The IRS makes it clear you've got to ask for annual certification from the employee. You can take the employee's word that they're covered under their spouse's plan. You don't, like, have to go to their employer, be it Intel or whoever, and find out, you know, prove to me you got the coverage. But if the employer becomes aware that the employee is not being truthful and doesn't actually have the coverage, that's covered by an anti-abuse rule. So if you have reason to believe that the employee is lying to you, then you essentially have to go ahead and get other, you have to demand other proof, or not give the payment to that employee. Now, there are a few other things in these regulations. There is information about the elimination of the normal waiver for a taxpayer ends up with income below 100% of the federal poverty level with eligibility for Medicaid or CHIP. If the person had intentionally and reckless disregard of the facts, gave the exchange erroneous information. So either they intentionally gave it or they didn't. We have rules here for individuals who successfully appeal termination by the exchange. They're not eligible for an advance credit payment and retroactively exchange to retain coverage as to whether they'll be subject with a shared responsibility penalty. We have rules related to a benchmark plan premium and information on and information related to information reporting. Again, if you have anything in any of those, be sure to go ahead and check out these proposed regs. As always, we have information and links to the proposed regs on the current federal taxdevelopments.com website and in the PDF that you can find on the weekly updates portion of our website for this week's broadcast. So you can go ahead and, you know, find that information and read those regulations. Can make it very useful, you know, stuff that you really should know and may very well be important beyond simply the employer one that we discussed here today. Next up, we're looking at the question of a taxpayer trying to claim a deduction for home mortgage interest. This is Jackson versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2016-33, issued on July 6th. Now, in this case, the taxpayer claimed he had an arrangement with his girlfriend that they would, you know, pay for a shared residence. He was not on the mortgage or deed because it turns out his credit wasn't so wonderful. So in one sense, this isn't an unusual relationship. We have many people who are not married, right, but are living together. And then we also have the issue there of those people. Sometimes, you know, they're going to acquire a house. They may acquire it together, you know, but let's say one of them has bad credit. Well, the way lenders think, they don't want to lend to two people if one has bad credit, but they will lend to one person if that person doesn't have bad credit. So what ends up happening is, in many cases, that person buys the house and, you know, that person's on the mortgage title. The other person's not there. That's what was happening in this case, or at least what the taxpayer was alleging. Now, the question is, can he claim a deduction for home mortgage interest? And the reality is, the regulations make clear that you actually can do it if you can show equitable ownership of the property and you actually paid the mortgage. Now, he had a letter from his girlfriend that claimed that they had this arrangement, but she didn't actually show up at court and she couldn't be questioned by the judge. He also claimed he had given her $1,000 a month, you know, made $1,000 a month toward paying the mortgage, but he never produced any evidence of that in court. So the court said essentially two things. Number one, because your girlfriend didn't testify and we weren't able to talk to her, we're not just going to accept this letter that you're presenting that you claim is from your girlfriend. You know, you should have put her on the stand and we should have been able to listen to her testimony. The court also said we have a little trouble believing you have this real arrangement, not relationship, because if she really does mean you own half the house, you'd think somewhere you would have put that in writing where you both signed off. You didn't have any of that. And finally, even if you had qualified for equitable ownership, the reality is that you didn't give us any evidence that you actually paid. Because, oh, by the way, even if you have equitable ownership and therefore has a right to claim part of the mortgage interest, you still have to prove you paid it. And he couldn't prove he had paid it. Now, the big thing there, what many of our clients and things in situations like this think is, well, you know, we can split this however we want, because as long as nobody claims too much, you know, as long as we're not claiming more than's on the 1098, there's no problem. Reality is that's not the way the code reads. And the reality is, as this case shows, you know, each person has to be able to show that they actually have the liability on the mortgage. They're the owner. The person on title, pretty easy for them. You know, the person, though, who claims to have equitable ownership who's not on the title, you need a bit more than just their word. And at the end of the day, the court felt that's all they had here was a guy's word. And frankly, he wasn't believable to the court's view, so tough luck. Next up, we revisit a case that we talked about a year ago, Methvin versus Commissioner, because Mr. Methvin did not like the answer. This is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-81 that was issued in April of 2015. Now, he appealed that to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in 117 AFR 2nd, paragraph 2016-809, issued on June the 24th, a decision that effectively sustained the tax court. The problem in this case is the guy bought a working interest in oil and gas wells. And many of us have clients that have bought those. You know, you buy those things, you own some very, very small percentage of various wells. And you get these long reports, and you got to report on each well. And you get, you know, you let's say, you know, you put money in to buy it. And then every month you get this statement from them where you get payments from them based on what the wells produced, less certain taxes or any other expenses that may be offset against that. The question becomes, is this subject to self-employment tax? It's reported to you on a 1099 miscellaneous. But, you know, the average client that at least I have who invests in these things, you know, they would know an oil well if they walked into it. They've never been at the well. They do nothing for it. So since he did nothing and it's a 1099 miscellaneous, his theory was I can't owe self-employment tax. Well, the problem is that while for a business, let's say that you own a sole proprietorship generally, you can only owe self-employment tax if you carry on the trade or business. And obviously, he's not carrying on the trade or business in this state because he's not doing anything with regard to this oil well except cashing checks. That doesn't really qualify as carrying on a trade or business. But the problem is, if it's a partnership, partnerships are subject to more detailed and more, you know, subject to a different set of rules. In a partnership, if the partnership's carrying on a trade or business, then your share of that's subject to SE tax unless you're a limited partner. And in this case, you know, the guy's not a limited partner. So there's our problem. It's not a limited partnership, so we have a little issue. Well, you know, the guy said, wait, this thing's not giving me a K-1. It's opted out from subchapter K. So it's not really a partnership. The tax court said it doesn't matter. It opts out for regular income tax purposes. That opt-out does not cover self-employment tax. The 10th Circuit in this case agreed with the tax court. This is a partnership, despite the fact it opted out for other income tax purposes, and Methvin owes self-employment tax. That income is self-employment income. He can't get out of it by saying, I didn't do anything. That's not a relevant point under at this point in time. As long as he was not a limited partner, he's basically stuck with having to pay the self-employment tax. Again, not a good result, but probably one that's not surprising. Most of us have seen those 1099 miscellaneous as non-employee comp. You know, it's been subject to SE tax. And if you want to know why it is, hey, there's the reason why it is. Next up and finally, or now I should say next up, not quite finally, we have the IRS has, in the case of Luke versus Commissioner, L-U-K-U-E, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing this gentleman's name, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-128. The tax court was initially confused by the IRS's record-keeping system. Now, the taxpayer had an overpayment on his 2011 return. The IRS applied that to 2009. Now, somewhere shortly after this, the IRS opened an exam on the taxpayer, initially said that he owed tax. In tax court, had now agreed that he actually didn't owe any more tax on 2011. But the problem was now the taxpayer said, well, tax court ordered them to give me my refund. Now, normally the IRS has the right, you know, basically to apply overpayments against outstanding tax liabilities, but they have to actually do so. And the question became now at the date of the court had the right to order this back if the IRS had not actually applied it. Well, the taxpayer was saying effectively here, the key point that was actually looked at by the court in detail was, well, the IRS hadn't properly applied it. The IRS had argued in court that the taxpayer had filed their tax return late. Despite that, when we looked at the IRS's records, the IRS's printout showed that the overpayment had been applied on April the 15th of that year. You know, so April 15th of 2012, they applied the overpayment against 2009. The taxpayer said, well, that's obviously wrong because they didn't have my return until May. How in the world could they have applied the refund in April of 2015 if they didn't actually have the return until May? They had no idea that there was a refund until May. The tax court said, well, I'm a little confused about that. But the IRS came back and gave an explanation. That explanation is what's really important about this case. The IRS points out that under their rules and under the regulations, the way they work internally, they always apply it. Any overpayment for a year is always applied as of April 15th if they're applying to an open tax liability. The reason they do that, they point out, is that works in the taxpayer's favor. Because if, in fact, you know, they said from their viewpoint, it was overpaid as of April 15th. It is consistent with their history, and it stops the interest running. And they're saying, look, we had the money. We're going to accept that we can stop the interest running. They said this is a taxpayer-friendly provision. And so even though it says that date, we just retroactively apply it, and that's how our methods work. Okay. There was one other issue, though, that had to be explained. That day, that year, April 15th, wasn't the actual day for filing. Actually, that year, April 17th of 2012, if you go back and look at your calendar, was the day that the returns were actually due. So is that a problem? If we apply it on the due date, why didn't we apply it as of April 17th? The IRS said, look, administratively, for simplicity, we don't worry about the extended due date there. We treat every return as timely filed. You know, we just say that. We just treat them as if filed on April 15th. And because, honestly, their computer systems are creaky enough that probably if they tried to actually program in all those dates, everything would fall apart. And again, you would point out, and you'd say again, to any extent, this is taxpayer friendly because, you know, we lose a couple of days of it. There's a couple of days of interest we don't get charged for. So the IRS said, you know, realistically, we've explained why this is so. The tax court said, we agree. Therefore, it was properly applied. Therefore, we don't have a problem. So we're going to go ahead and accept this and not worry about that. And, you know, sorry here, taxpayer, you don't get a claim, the overpayment. You know, we're not going to pay out the refund. Okay. Now, as I said, we're coming up again. I mentioned here I'm going to be in September there in Iowa. But we've got a whole bunch of other things happening. Be sure you go to your state society's website and check out the live courses that are available. The nice thing about live courses are you get to meet your fellow CPAs. So, you know, you can actually talk real people. It's interesting. You can talk to real people. It's also, while we do take questions and answers on webcasts and webinars, and I certainly enjoy doing those, the reality is that it's a lot easier to handle the questions live in a live session than it is in a session where we're basically separated by web. So, you know, consider going out, seeing your state society, booking your courses, and going out and seeing your fellow CPAs. And the other neat thing about it is, you know, you take a specialized course, which the state societies are very good at offering on more specialized topics than other CPE providers that you may be able to get things from. You're going to also be able to talk to other CPAs in the area who actually work in that area and have an interest in that area, that can give you resources that you can turn to when you have issues in later year. You know, you have issues down the line. You know other people in your area who work in that area. So it's actually not a bad idea. So certainly consider looking at your state society websites and consider going and taking those courses. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of July 11th, 2016. Be sure to catch our daily updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download there a PDF with articles about all this week's cases. You want to also be sure, if you have any questions or if you have any comments, send them to edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You got a question on any of the things we discussed this week, or you have anything else you think we should be talking about, go ahead and put it there. You can also follow me on Twitter at edzollers.com. or at edzollers.com on Twitter. I will basically, when we post something new on the website, which we do all kinds of times during the week, we do that multiple times, you'll be sure to find me. Whenever it posts up, it also goes out on the Twitter stream, so you can find out whenever we posted something new. So go ahead, follow us there, and you know, make sure that you keep up. We'll see you next week when we'll talk about more tax-related issues.